could remember your names. So you were Chris then, I got that.
Yes.
It's okay, Chris. Heather. Sorry?
It's Itzko.
Okay. And sorry?
Kyle.
Sorry, say again?
Kyle.
Kyle. And
Henry.
Henry, Kyle, Chris, Heather, Itzko. Okay. I'm probably going to forget it all within an hour, but hopefully by the end of the week I'll have it down. Okay, so this week we're going to be covering sort of a bunch of miscellaneous topics. And so what I'm going to actually do in today's lecture is sort of give more of a motivation for why we want to introduce these additional, or why we want to look at some of these topics in particular. We're going to spend a bit of time discussing this generalized harmonic and BSSN evolution, so mostly generalized harmonic. But one of the motivations is like, why do we have to go beyond ADM? So as Matt covered the ADM formalism last week, a couple of weeks ago, but it turns out that that's not going to be adequate for the kinds of things that we want to do if we're interested in gravitational wave astronomy or 3D computation. And then some of the computational issues, it turns out that when we go beyond spherical symmetry or the simple symmetry-reduced problems, the computation can be done on single PC, so we have to parallelize. And beyond that, we have to also be much more efficient. We can do unigrid evolution, so we have to do things like adaptive mesh refinement. And also a couple of other topics that I want to sort of touch on, which is important in numerical simulation, particularly the field equations. So we're solving the Einstein equations for the space-time metric. And at the end of the day, so we get a set of fields that represents this, you know, the components of the metric over a four-dimensional grid. Well, how do you interpret that? What does that mean? So we're in particular these days a thing that people are interested in are gravitational waves. So how do you characterize gravitational waves? Black holes are interesting, or we don't put black holes into the simulations. They're not like particles as they would be in Newtonian gravity. We have to sort of extract that from the simulation. And so a tremendous amount of the work that you do in numerical relativity is try to understand space-time geometry, or the set of numbers that you get from these simulations. This is sort of, again, what I was, just sort of a rehash of what I said. So today, I think, you know, in my opinion, there's sort of two sort of exciting frontiers of research in gravity. One is gravitational wave astrophysics. And in particular, where numerical relativity fits into that is in compact object mergers, so binary black hole or binary neutron star mergers. So I'll give you a little bit of an overview of that, like what's interesting about gravitational wave physics, and then also describe a very brief overview of what the nature of gravitational waves are in general relativity. I mean, this might be, you know, old stuff to some of you, but just, and this will also give you some idea of, like, I'll show you some movies of gravitational waves from the simulation, but it's really, there's something called the Newman-Penrose scalar, and I'll just show you the relationship between what you usually think of as a gravitational wave and a Newman-Penrose scalar. And then some of the other interesting things are just studies of sort of dynamical strong field gravity, in particular of in regimes that are relevant to either sort of string theory motivated high energy situation, like perhaps black hole formation at the LHC, or higher dimensional gravity, or just theoretical studies within GR. Like some of these topics, we don't expect these kinds of structures to be out there in the universe, but they are interesting to explore nonetheless. And so both of these require numerical simulation. I guess there is another part of gravity that's very interesting today, and that's cosmology in particular. It might relate to dark energy, perhaps dark matter. But for the most part, that's something that you usually don't need numerical techniques to solve. That's sort of expected to be in a regime where gravity is sort of weakly perturbing a background geometry. Okay, so just a sort of a very, very brief overview of what's happening in gravitational wave astrophysics. And perhaps I'm speaking too soon, but I think, you know, the next decade or two is going to be a very exciting time in gravitational wave astronomy because of this concerted effort across the globe to try and observe the universe in gravitational waves. So here are the LIGO interferometers that you've probably heard of. There are a few other sites, Virgo and GEO. So these are ground-based interferometers that are trying to detect gravitational waves. There's a planned space-based mission, LISA, There've been, over the past couple of decades, there's been a lot of work on these resonant bar detectors. That's sort of fading away a little bit. And there are also other ways in which people are trying to observe gravitational waves by observing certain properties of the universe. For example, a pulsar timing. Pulsars are very accurate clocks. And if there's a gravitational wave that passes between a pulsar and the Earth, you could, in principle, infer, sort of directly measure that gravitational wave by looking at the residuals in the pulsar timing signal and polarization of the cosmic microwave background. So gravitational waves polarize the background. So as of now, no gravitational waves have been detected. So this, the LIGO has been going for quite a few years, but it isn't quite yet at the sensitivity where people expect that they might have detected something. But perhaps what this might show is that there's really a huge effort about the world to try to open up this new spectrum into the universe. So to give you an idea of what we might expect to see when these detectors finally start detecting objects. So here on the vertical axis is sort of the strength of the source. And the horizontal axis is the frequency. So one thing just on the horizontal axis that you can immediately see is the huge range of frequencies that we expect sources to be emitting gravitational waves at. And so that directly implies that gravitational waves can probe a huge range of sort of fundamental physical and astrophysical processes in the universe. In terms of the sources, so the strongest sources we expect to be binary black hole mergers. In a nutshell, relativity predicts gravitational waves when they're bulk concentrations of matter energy that are moving relative to each other. And the stronger you want the source, the more concentrated you want that energy. And so black holes are about as strong sources as we can imagine. And you want them to be going as fast as possible. And for black holes, just before they merge, they're going at a sizable fraction of the speed of light. So that's why these are expected to be the strongest sources. So at the lower frequency end, there's the supermassive black holes, millions to billions of solar masses, going down to the LIGO band, where we go down to stellar mass black holes. Then some other interesting sources, neutron star black hole mergers, binary neutron star systems, just binaries, so that they don't actually merge, neutron star binaries or white dwarf binaries, extreme mass ratio in spiral, so small compact objects spiraling into a black hole, supernovae, pulsars. And then here, sort of a whole bunch of things, if you will, like exotic physics. Much less certain whether any of these objects, like cosmic strings or domain holes, are actually present in the universe, or what possible relics there might be from the Big Bang. But this is actually perhaps one of the more exciting prospects with gravitational waves. Because one property of a gravitational wave is after it's produced at the source, it interacts incredibly weakly with matter. So this gravitational wave propagates outwards. It's going to be lensed a little bit by the gravitational effects of the matter, but it's not going to be absorbed by the matter at all. And so if there were gravitational waves produced in the very, very early universe, even all the way back to very close to the Big Bang, there is a possibility that we could observe it essentially unobstructed. For example, like photons, we can't go beyond the cosmic microwave background. That's sort of a wall beyond which electromagnetic observations can penetrate. Neutrinos can go further back than photons, but still not as far as gravitational waves. So this is really potentially a probe to go almost all the way back to the Big Bang. Okay, but so what numerical relativity is sort of focusing on these days is sort of the compact object part of the spectrum. So from binary black hole mergers to neutron star black hole and neutron star mergers. So just a sort of an overview of what makes these things complicated and what were some of the computational issues. Well, first of all, so the binary black hole system is a very clean problem in some sense. So it's vacuum GR, so it's just purely geometry. In the universe, there's never going to be a perfect vacuum system, right? At the very, very least, if you have a binary, it's going to be bathed in the cosmic microwave background. But for black hole systems, they expect it. I'm not sure if it's a connection, but yeah. Seems like it is becoming worse, right? In any case, I'll just try to say in words everything that's written here. So in, for a vacuum system, it's a very clean system. The expected ambient matter that might be there is not going to be dynamically significant, at least for the most part. There might be, you know, the CMB photon is completely insignificant. There might be some circumbinary disk, but that's going to be incredible. It's not going to have any mass relative to the mass of the black hole. So from in terms of modeling the event, we can just look at vacuum GR. Neutron stars, on the other way, if you want to look at neutron star systems or black hole neutron star systems, that becomes very complicated. And in particular, so you can almost think of numerical GR as being sufficiently clean that you really are solving the field equations. You're using numerical methods, so there's going to be some approximation, but you really are calculating. You're solving the field equations. However, when you start looking at matter systems like neutron stars, so I mean, these, first of all, they've got a complicated structure. Sort of neutrons, there's going to be some protons, it could be electrons, it could have a crust, there could be a superfluid core, it could be vortices in the neutron star, they could have magnetic fields. So it's a very complicated system. But there's no way that you can ever model that from the fundamental physical equations that govern this matter, like quantum electrodynamics, quantum chromodynamics. You have to model, you have to approximate these things. And so, for example, one, the simplest approximation, well, let's consider it to be a perfect fluid with a certain equation of state. So that's sort of what we were doing last week, you know, with these shock capturing methods. So the interesting thing about neutron stars is in terms of how complicated the thing is compared to black holes. With black holes, we just have to solve the classical field equations. They're complicated, but it's a perfectly well-prescribed system. With neutron stars, because we have to model, there's no way we can solve the fundamental equations. You have to approximate them to some degree. There's really, like, the sky's the limit to how complicated these approximations or the modeling can be. And how far you have to go sort of depends on the questions that you want to answer. If you're just interested in the gravitational wave signal, it might be sufficient to not worry about too much of the microphysics. But for example, one of the interesting prospects of, you know, gravitational wave astronomy that there could be an electromagnetic counterpart. In particular, there's, for example, binary neutron star or black hole neutron star systems are conjectured to be associated or sources of a certain class of short gamma ray bursts. No one knows if it's possible. So it's back of the envelope calculations. The energetics works out, but no one knows for certain. And so if you wanted to be able to answer, or first observations will tell you that, but to be able to sort of model it, you need to include radiation and neutrino effects if you want to see the electromagnetic and other counterparts. Incidentally, one thing that I didn't sort of mention, like why simulation is important for an observational field of astronomy, which you can sort of think of gravitational waves as a field of observation. It's not like a traditional telescope. You know, you turn on your detector and you observe the universe in gravitational waves. One problem, gravitational wave sources are incredibly energetic events. They pump a huge amount of energy into space-time distortion, which is a gravitational wave. However, the amplitude of that distortion is incredibly small. In particular, it decays like 1/1 the distance from the source. So by the time it gets to Earth, it's an incredibly small perturbation. And so in particular, even to the LIGO instrument, there's these 4-kilometer-long arms that does laser interferometry to detect changes in relative distance between the two arms. They can detect distances or changes in distances that are sort of a fraction of the diameter of a proton, over 4 kilometers. And I mean, that's an incredible sensitivity. And even so, they won't directly be able to see the distortions. The distortions are going to be smaller than that. And so the way in which they hope to be able to observe these events is through match filtering. So you simulate a class of sources that you expect to be out there. You convolve that with a signal, and then you sort of that will increase the effective signal to noise ratio of the event. So simulation is really a crucial part of the initial detectors for them to actually work. Hopefully, LISA might be able to directly see some strong sources, and you know, you can imagine in the future they could become sensitive enough to directly observe. But at least in the next few years, that's not going to happen. Okay. I wonder. I mean, this is quite irritating. Are you actually But what, I can just turn it this way, and perhaps if you guys want to come in a bit closer, we can just do that. Let's see.
For Francis.
Sorry?
Maybe you have now. Okay. I thought it had to do with the resolution, but now it's still. Because, yeah, when you go back.
Oh, is that? Oh, sorry.
Yeah, when you don't have like full screen, it seems to be on.
Yeah, yeah, let's.
This all started when they were working on repairing some of the.
Okay, so it's a physical. You must be loose cables.
Yeah.
Okay, so this is also more just for. Okay, so yeah, everyone can see that. That's good. Okay, so in this part of this week, we're really just going to be focusing on the vacuum problem. So that's relatively complicated, but it's nice and clean. If you want to start getting into neutron stars, the first order, leading order model is fluids. And that's the things that you've been working on last week. But incidentally, how many of you have sort of finished the ultra-relativistic? Is you close to it? Are you going to still be working on it today? Or?
I imagine
so. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, good. Cause
yes.
Yeah, because like one project for this week, so I mean, you can just, you know, I think you're take your time and make sure you sort of understand that there's no pressure to get to the third project. But those of you that do get there, we're going to be doing the Tucholsky equations, so just the gravitational wave perturbations of a Kerr background. The notes are almost complete, but I haven't yet put it up on the way. Yeah. So it is in, but.
It is in, but
I've switched it to this thing. So. One thing, yeah, but okay. So right. So I'll try and. So one problem is the dual screen thing here doesn't work with animations. But so I'll flip back and forth. So I think now it should be. So I've switched it back to dual. But when I show a couple of animations, I'll switch back and I'll try and go back and forth. Okay. No problem. Okay. So. Okay, so things could be. So it's going to be a very interesting modeling problem, you know, especially with neutron stars for the next, you know, I think, for the foreseeable future. Okay, so the next sort of complication is the final stages of the merger. You have to use numerical techniques. There are no known analytical methods at work. So the early stages, you can use these post-Newtonian perturbative methods. I mean, in principle, for the last stages, at least for a black hole system, you can use perturbative methods as well. But sort of very close to merger, you need numerical techniques. And for mergers, they're never going to happen head-on in nature. It's always going to be an in-spiral. And so there's no symmetry in the problem. So you need a full 3+1 evolution scheme. And one problem that it introduces, and Luis probably mentioned a bit about this, is, well, first of all, the ADM formulation that I think Matt covered, that turns out to be weakly hyperbolic, which has problems with the numerical scheme. So you need a reformulation of the field equations. But even more so, the fact that the ADM formalism was problematic sort of spurred this cottage industry of finding new formulations in the late 1990s and the early 2000s. But even so, it turns out that the vast majority of them are unstable when you do a so-called free evolution. So, you know, with the field equations, and so any sort of initial boundary value problem way of posing it, at any one time slice, it's an overdetermined system. There are these constraints. And so the usual way in which people approach is, well, we solve the constraints on the initial surface, and then with a subset of hyperbolic equations, you evolve it forwards in time. And at the analytic level there, that's perfectly fine. The constraints will be preserved by the evolution equations. The problem is if you now introduce a small perturbation that doesn't satisfy the constraints, the question is what happens to that even at the analytic level? And it turns out that the vast majority of ways of writing the field equations, so even at the analytic level, you start with a solution to the initial data problem plus a perturbation, an arbitrary perturbation, so one that could violate the constraints, and generically grows exponentially with time. So you think, okay, analytically, well, let's just not start with initial data that has that. But when you do a numerical approximation, you're going to introduce truncation errors. And so and there's no way you can control whether those truncation errors satisfy the constraints or not. In general, they will not satisfy the constraints. So you need a system where you can sort of control the growth of those exponential modes. And today, there are really only two systems that work, the generalized harmonic form and this BSSN, Baumgart, Shapiro, Shibata, Nakamura. So I'll sort of derive the generalized harmonic form, and I'll briefly mention the BSSN. So first of all, ADM is weakly hyperbolic, but it also has, you can imagine, there's some ways you can sort of try to imagine to get around that numerically. But even so, then it has these exponentially growing modes. And then on top of that, getting a strongly or symmetric hyperbolic system is generally not good enough. It has to sort of be well-behaved off the constraint manifold. So and other issues that become then problematic in 3 plus 1, so things that are perhaps slightly different than in a situation where you have a symmetry that you can take advantage of, is gauge conditions, boundary conditions, the fact that you have to deal with black hole singularities. So for example, like the coordinate freedom, that's a difficult problem in general, in particular if you don't have a symmetry that could guide what the coordinates have to do, because in a dynamical nonlinear field theory, where you're solving for something which is the representation of the metric is intimately related to the coordinates that you've chosen, you can't sort of disentangle those two. Getting a well-behaved evolution is a lot of the technology of doing that is finding a well-behaved coordinate system as well. Okay, so we need to go to 3D, which makes things complicated, but what makes things even more complicated or computationally complicated is that the problems that we're interested in typically have several orders of magnitude of relevant length scales that have to be resolved. So if we just think of the simplest binary black hole system, there are at least 3 orders of magnitude of spatial scales. So the smallest scale is just going to be the radius of the black hole. You have to resolve the orbital motion, and so typically the final stages, they're going to be at separations of roughly 10 times each of their sizes. But in the strong field regime where all this dynamics is happening, you can't unambiguously quantify what a gravitational wave is. So if we want to understand what the gravitational wave emission is from the system, we have to go sufficiently far away that we're in the weak field regime. And so that's so typically you have to go to, again, another 10 times further out. So we have a large range of physical length scales that have to be resolved. And yet, because it's the only characteristic sort of quantity in the field equations is the speed of light, essentially any spatial scale that you have, the corresponding time scale in which dynamical things will happen is the local speed of light. So when you have a small spatial scale, you have to have a correspondingly small sort of time step, a Courant factor, because things are going to be wanting to propagate at the speed of light. Of course, if you start including matter, that all hell can break loose. In particular, because then you could get things at sort of microphysical timescales. So, if, for example, if you want to explore the accretion disks that form around, say, a binary neutron star merger, there could be magnetic fields, but these things are generally going to be unstable. You're going to get the magneto-rotational instability, which is going to sort of cause a turbulent cascade down to small scales. And if it's important to resolve that, you just have to do that. Or certain things like, for example, gamma ray bursts. There's a certain, an interesting class of these objects where there's an initial burst and afterwards there's a late time flare that happens. So these neutron stars, the final stages happen in milliseconds. There's a burst that happens on that same time scale and this late time flare happens perhaps 2 or 3 seconds afterwards, perhaps sometimes 10 seconds or afterwards. And so relative to the local time scale of this sort of accretion disk system, that's a huge time afterwards. And so if you want to try to understand that system, like one example of what might be happening is that these things, they merge, the neutron star is tightly sort of torn apart, and matter is flung out on these large sort of the centric orbits and eventually come back and crash back either into the central neutron star or black hole system. And so if you need to resolve those, so at that stage you might not need full general relativity, but you need to do all the hydrodynamic stuff. So that can increase the computational costs by many orders of magnitude. But the bottom line is then you need at least parallel computing, but you also need more efficient algorithms to deal with these situations. And for these kind of, so at least the vacuum problem where you have sort of two compact objects, before crazy things starts to happen with matter, this adaptive mesh refinement is a very efficient way of dealing with the length scale issue. If you have small scale features that are sort of volume filling, so you can imagine, well, like an accretion disk is not quite volume filling, but at least in the plane, the turbulence could be happening throughout the disk, and so you have to resolve all those scales throughout the disk, then mesh refinement is not that efficient. But if you have sort of isolated small scale features, then mesh refinement is efficient. I'll show you a couple of examples of that. Here's an example of a simulation of a binary black hole merger. This is through the equatorial plane. What's showing you is the lapse function. So this is actually done with a generalized harmonic evolution scheme, but it's very convenient to represent stuff with. Or the lapse is a very useful way of looking at it. So these are initially two non-spinning black holes, and this is the little black dots there are the excised regions. So there are a couple of ways of sort of dealing with the singularities in this harmonic form, and you just cut that piece out of the grid. And essentially the reason behind that, I guess you did it in the first week with the Schwarzschild waves on the Schwarzschild background, is essentially you don't have to put an inner boundary condition if your inner boundary is inside the horizon because of the causal structure of the space-time. All the characteristics are flowing out of the domain. And in fact, you can place a boundary condition. You can only place boundary conditions on sort of numerical modes that are coming into the domain. So the actual black hole horizons are a little bit outside these black dots. Another thing, so the time scale here, M, is the mass of the system. Again, in the field equations, there's no intrinsic length scale. So the problem introduces a length scale, and here it's the mass of the black hole. So we just scale things by the mass of the black hole. And so we can, in the end, the only thing that's important is the mass ratio. And for a given mass ratio, we can scale it to any problem we want. So this is an example. So you can see they're orbiting around each other. They're emitting gravitational waves now. You don't see the waves in the lapse function. But because of that, it's the binary spiraling in. And eventually it's going to merge, form a distorted Kerr black hole that's going to quickly ring down to a stationary Kerr black hole because of the no-hair theorems. Just to put some numbers in, initially these were non-spinning black holes. This forms a Kerr black hole with a spin of 0.7. So remember that the maximally possible spinning black hole in general relativity is a parameter of 1. And this that parameter is the angular momentum per unit mass. So this is a relatively rapidly spinning black hole, and about 4% of the energy was emitted in gravitational waves, which is a huge amount of energy. So if you think, so one of the systems at LIGO, so LIGO's sort of sweet spot is in the close to a kilohertz range, and that would correspond to about 210 solar mass black holes. So if you think 210 solar mass black hole, that's 20 solar masses. So 4% of the energy of that system, that's one whole sun, solar mass equals mc squared. That's, in this case, in about a few milliseconds is converted to gravitational energy. So it's a huge amount of energy. It's actually, it approaches the Planck luminosity for this short amount of time close to the merger. And yet, despite that amount of energy, the strength of the perturbation, so the way that it stretches space-time is so small that we need these incredibly complicated interferometers to detect it. So this is the gravitational wave emission measured by this quantity called the Newman-Penrose scalar. So now this is sort of zoomed out from the previous simulation, so the two little black holes are over there. And as I mentioned before, in the dynamical regime, there's no unambiguous way to define what a gravitational wave is. The way that gravitational waves are defined, and we'll go over this if we have time, we'll sort of go over this on the blackboard, is as a perturbation relative to some background. So if you have a background structure, you can define what a gravitational wave is relative to that. So What's actually a very convenient way of calculating that in a simulation is this thing called the Newman-Penrose scalar. And it's proportional to the second time derivative of the usual gravitational wave of the metric perturbation. So yeah, this is one of the polarizations. So this will be the gravitational wave structure. This quantity that you compute is the second time derivative of that. So you compute this, you integrate it twice to get that. Yeah.
So is the question about the last simulation? Yeah. Waves in the lapsed function is because there's no polar, you can't have time-like polarization. Is that right?
Or there will actually be waves, but they're going to be very, very small relative to that. So the lapsed function is, it's of order unity. Okay. And so it's partly a gauging. This is invariant, a gauge invariant quantity in any way. Mm-hmm. But if, for example, if you differentiated this function, or if you sort of could subtract the average one, you would see sort of waves propagate outward. It would be difficult to associate them with gravitational waves and with the wave polarization, but there would be. So this Newman-Penrose scalar is a way of taking this four-dimensional metric, and with a very sort of algebraic standard, there's no complication in computing what these scalars are, just a space-time scalar. And then if you're sufficiently far away that your metric looks Minkowski, then you can interpret it as a gravitational wave. So first of all, that initial burst was an artifact of the initial data. So it's a correct initial data, but it's not part of the physical solution. But now you see these sort of quadrupolar waves that are propagating outwards, and that's the gravitational waves that are produced by the source. So again, in the region sort of near the two black holes, you can interpret it as gravitational waves, but it's only sort of in the distant region. This is a logarithmic color scale. So if I just showed you like a linear color scale, you wouldn't have seen the beginning part of the waves. But as a consequence, you can sort of see this structure, which is just that's a truncation error artifact. It's not really, that's not part of the solution. This version of PowerPoint. If you play one animation twice without going back and forth, it crashes. Let me see if I can end it. So what was I saying? So this Newman-Penrose scalar, you can see close by, it's got some complicated structure. Far away, it represents the waves. And this waveform was actually taken at a distance, looking straight down at the axis of the black hole. And so if you take this value and you just integrate it twice, you get the waveform. So this is sort of the strain in the gravitational wave signal. Okay, so to give you some idea of like the adaptive mesh refinement structure, so this is a coordinate system where spatial coordinates have been chosen that go to spatial infinity. So this actually is spatial infinity. It's sort of just a tangent transformation. And the reason for doing that was just to solve because boundary conditions can be a real problem. And so in codes today where the boundary isn't at spatial infinity, you can often see like crap coming from the boundaries. And so what they typically do with those simulations is they just make the boundary sufficiently far away that all the interesting dynamics happens in less than a light crossing time. But the other alternative is just to go to spatial infinity with one of these compactification functions. So the resolution here is terrible. I mean, because like the last jump goes from a finite distance to infinity. But the idea is, okay, we're just using this to impose the correct mathematical boundary conditions that it's Minkowski at that point, and we're going to measure the waves in this region. So we're not going to let the waves go to infinity. We're going to measure them in this region. And what I wanted to show you here was just the mesh structure. And so you can see that the black holes are sort of there, the center is now like zooming in onto the... So the different zones that I mentioned before, so like the wave zone could sort of be in this area.
So the wavelength of the waves are roughly the orbital size. So you don't need too much resolution to resolve the waves, but you want to resolve the orbital motion and you want to resolve the individual black holes. And so you can just sort of see visually now in one, sort of focusing on one of them, is this adaptive mesh refinement is it's only adding resolution where it needs it and not more. Because the back of the envelope calculation in a 3D code, so the number of points that you have, if you have sort of n point, or so the amount of computational costs, you have like nx by ny by nz and nt, so you're going to have to take nt time steps. Say that's all roughly of order n. The computational cost goes like n to the fourth. So if you need this resolution to resolve the smaller scales, you know, it would be insane to sort of cover this entire domain with a uniform grid of that same resolution. It's just, even with the fastest computer today, you wouldn't be able to do it. So mesh refinement really helps you a lot in, that makes it a practical problem today. Okay, so I think I was going to now sort of just, since I'd shown you the gravitational waves, sort of derive the structure on the board, but let's just go through the, let's just sort of finish through this, and then I'll, because it's already running a bit late, and then either at the end of this lecture or perhaps at the beginning of tomorrow's lecture, we can just do a brief overview of gravitational waves. So, this is sort of standard textbook stuff, so there are a lot of textbooks that do it well. But these couple of review articles are nice because it's more, more of a modern approach, in particular keeping the gravitational wave astrophysics in mind. So this, the Bionano one in particular is more focused on gravitational wave detection. The Flanagan and Hughes is sort of more theoretical, but they both have sort of self-contained description of gravitational waves. And I guess before we get to that, let me just sort of give you some of the other motivations. One of them is higher dimensional gravity, and actually there are many interesting things in higher dimensional gravity. This is just one of the things that lately has been, for the last 10 years or so, is the possibility that there are extra dimensions, and what that could imply is that the Planck scale is not what we think it might be, you know, 10 to the 19 GeV, but actually much lower. What's happening, so I guess you've all heard about the hierarchy problem, and so one way of saying it is, well, one way of posing this problem is, why is gravity so weak compared with the other fundamental forces? Why is there, you know, 15 orders of magnitude or whatever between, you know, the electroweak scale and what we think of as quantum gravity scale, so the Planck scale? And what this solution, the way that this solves the problem is, it says, well, actually, there isn't this hierarchy problem. Gravity is just as strong as all the other forces. But we think that it's much weaker than it is because we don't realize that there are these small microscopic dimensions. And so if we could sort of then probe to sufficiently small scales and we see those dimensions, we'll notice that gravity is much, much stronger. And it's stronger by the volume, so the ratio of the volume of these extra dimensions. So depending on the structure of the extra dimensions, you can change what our effective four-dimensional gravitational constant is relative to those. And sort of an arbitrary way of doing it. But then to solve the hierarchy problem, you choose numbers so that gravity is at the TeV scale. Now, apparently that introduces a lot of problems in particle physics, but at least for solving the hierarchy problem, that's sort of an elegant possibility. But one of the interesting consequences of that then is if you eventually, like with particle collisions such as at the LHC, you start getting to these high energies. If you then go sufficiently above the Planck scale, which now is presumably at a TeV, so you go to 10 TeV or 14 TeV, whatever the LHC can do, the conjecture is that black holes will actually form. So the LHC will be a black hole factory. And incidentally, the arguments that this happens are sort of purely classical. So at the quantum, where quantum gravity is important, okay, all, who knows what happens there, but if you go sufficiently above the Planck scale, it should be a purely classical process. So to understand black hole formation at the LHC, if you're sufficiently above the Planck scale, is presumably mostly a classical calculation, at least the first part of it. So the question of what kind of black hole is formed, what the cross-section is, all of these things, that's purely classical GR. And then the way that they're going to detect these black holes, they're going to evaporate. They're going to Hawking evaporate very quickly. So that's then That's where the quantum process is coming, but at least the black hole formation is purely classical. So yeah, I'll just show you a couple of examples of, so at least now in 4D black hole collisions. Of course, if you want to do this with the LHC, you've got to go beyond four dimensions. And doing so directly, you know, by brute forces, that's not going to be possible with the computers in the near future. But one possible way of doing it is if you have a simple structure to the extra dimension. Say it might just be sort of a Kaluza-Klein type direction where you can dimensionally reduce it to an effective scalar field. Then you can do these as four-dimensional simulations with additional sort of dilaton fields that represent these dimensionally reduced extra dimensions. Here's an example of sort of four-dimensional black holes. So to start getting towards that point, this is a head-on collision. Again, this is showing one of these Newman-Penrose scalars. In this case, they're going to be colliding head-on at a gamma of 2.9. So an interesting, in all these simulations, you'll see this junk radiation. Again, that's just a pure artifact of the initial conditions. So the initial value problem is a complicated problem in relativity. So, I mean, I think so Matt probably mentioned what the constraint equations were. And so, like, solving them is, it's a set of nonlinear elliptic equations that have to solve. But what makes them perhaps more complicated is how do you separate out degrees of freedom that you specify that represent the problem versus those that are constrained by the equations? And there's no one has really solved that problem to the point where, for example, in like the astrophysical case, you saw that burst of radiation. Well, what we really want as the initial conditions, we imagine these black holes started very far apart. They slowly spiraled in, and then they got to this point where now we want to solve the field equations. So the correct initial data should include that wave train that the black holes had emitted in the past, whatever, million years. But we don't know how to do that, and so we just say, well, let's, for lack of a better way, so that initial data was conformally flat. So you say it's conformal to a flat metric, and that introduces this artificial burst. And in this case, you'll see that as well. So there's this burst of, so they're moving towards each other. This is totally an artifact of the initial data, but then the two black holes collide, and now you get this burst of energy. That's the energy emission from the collision of the two black holes. Incidentally, this simulation was done by Uli Spurhacke with the BSSN codes. The previous one was the harmonic. And the way, at least the way contemporary codes deal with the excisions in a harmonic is with this excision. And in BSSN, they've got this moving puncture method. So they actually, the singularity, it's a coordinate singularity where inside the black hole, but it's actually represented in the grid, so you don't cut it out at all. And so that's what you saw there. Just fun to so head-on collisions. If you start with two black holes at rest and you let them collide head-on, they release a fraction of a percent in energy compared to the 4% that I showed before. It's almost nothing. But when you go to the high-speed regime, it becomes much more energetic. For example, this case released about 8% of its rest mass energy, and it's probably extrapolated to infinity. It would be about 14%. But when you go to a grazing collision, so this is his BSSN code, things get much more complicated. This is the one that I showed you before. I guess I wanted to cut that slide out, but this was supposed to be the slide. Here's the head-on collision. The grazing collision is going to be, and this is actually with a much smaller gamma factor, but when you go off axis, what makes it such an why the emission rate goes up is now you start to get orbital motion. So the head-on collision, the black holes almost don't see each other before they collide with these large gamma factors because of the Lorentz contraction. And so this big black hole forms, and it's really just quasi-normal ring down that you see as the gravitational wave. So these gravitational waves is just this ring down of the black hole. But now when you go off axis, they don't quite merge immediately and you start to get orbital motion. But this is happening at close to the speed of light. So as I mentioned before, like how you get high emission is you want dense objects going close to the speed of light, and that's what happens here. So this was just rotated, it's the same thing, but you see that initial burst. But now they're slightly grazing, and so you see this huge burst, much larger burst of energy, and that's now it's formed a single black hole, and so you see the quasi-normal ring down mode. So these kinds of things we don't expect to happen in the universe, and probably there aren't extra dimensions of the form at the LHU, but if there are, that this is sort of where it's more relevant. I'm not going to sort of show any other examples, but another thing that's becoming interesting, or that people are sort of, it's perhaps a new area of research, is this ADS-CFT correspondence of string theory that you've probably all heard of. And so one way where classical relativity is playing a role is sort of looking at just higher dimensional gravity. So looking at higher dimensional gravity in anti-de Sitter space, that's due to, you know, a conformal field theory on the boundary in certain regimes. And so these days, sort of string theory sort of reinventing itself in trying to describe sort of non-quantum gravitational physics, you know, whether it's heavy ion collisions in the formation of a quark gluon plasma via the ADS-CFT correspondence or various condensed matter systems. And a useful tool in that is gravity in anti-de Sitter space. But we'll have that's another area where sort of classical relativity is, even though it's not related to gravitational waves, is sort of interesting. Matt might have mentioned this a bit, but I think this critical phenomenon in gravitational collapse, sort of the last example that I'll show, this sort of a poster child, first of mesh refinement, the use of mesh refinement, because you get length scales that develop exponentially fast, small length scales, but it's a single isolated length scale, so it's not like turbulence, which is volume filling. But this is also one of the rare examples where sort of numerics has discovered something fundamentally new in a theory, and it's a numerics. Usually, the way that they're applied is, okay, there's a system that's too complicated to solve analytically, or the initial conditions are too complicated to represent in some simple form. And so, understanding the details, you need numerical solutions. But it's usually the qualitative features, they're simple examples that you can sort of understand all the qualitative aspects of it. But here's something like sort of fundamentally new was discovered. It was discovered by Matt back in 93. And so he was just looking at black hole formation in spherical symmetry. And I think at the time, spherical symmetry, it was thought to be a solved problem. Okay, the details there might be a few details missing, but it was a solved problem. And for example, one of these details was to start with gravitational collapse of some distribution of matter. And he was particularly looking at a scalar field. And I guess Chris de Duleep sort of posed the question, can you form a black hole of from a massive scalar field collapse that's arbitrarily small? So you start with some macroscopic distribution that's got a characteristic size, and you let it collapse to form a black hole. What is the size of that black hole, and can you adjust your initial conditions to make an arbitrarily small black hole? So that's the question that Matt wanted to answer. And so in trying to answer that, he discovered this critical phenomena. And sort of kind of remarkably, so critical phenomena, you see it at sort of the threshold of black hole formation. And it's called critical phenomena because it resembles, at least mathematically, it's very similar to sort of critical behavior in statistical mechanics systems. So you see power law scaling, universality, scaling variance. It's not a statistical mechanical system, but it's sort of analogous behavior. So let me just highlight the question. So one way you can sort of imagine, well, the way you get to this critical regime, and one way you can sort of imagine probing this question of how small a black hole you form is by looking at gravitational collapse of a one-parameter family of initial data. So let's imagine the scalar fields like a ball of photons, and we parameterize the strength of this by some number, say p. So say the amplitude of the scalar field, so the density. Right? So you can imagine if p is very small, there's not much energy there, this stuff is just going to disperse. So the scalar field is like radiation, it's just going to fly apart. But as we start increasing the amplitude, especially if we make it very large, it's going to be sufficiently dense that it's going to collapse under its own weight and form a black hole. So now if we sort of do a bisection search, we sort of tune between these two bracketing cases, we can sort of approach the threshold of black hole formation. And that's where this critical phenomena arose. So let me just show you some examples of animation. So this is axisymmetric simulation, but it's actually spherically symmetric initial data. So this is sort of cylindrical coordinates. This is the axis of symmetry, rho z. This is the amplitude of the scalar field. So sort of imagine sort of like spinning it around this axis of symmetry. So this is your ball of scalar field energy. This is a very weak field data. So adjust sort of collapses to the origin, and you have this pulse that moves outwards at the speed of light. And nothing too interesting. This is what you'd get if you just looked at a scalar wave on a flat Minkowski background. Now this is a strong field case, and the amplitude is much larger, but I rescaled this just so that you can see the whole thing. And what happens here is essentially immediately it forms a black hole. And so this simulation use something called maximal slicing. And what happens is so a singularity is forming, a black hole actually formed there. We didn't have excision in this simulation, but this thing sort of asymptotes towards a singularity. So this singularity is forming there in the space-time and the scalar field. There isn't a horizon around that. But with these maximal coordinates, they never actually reach the singularity. It sort of slows down as you approach the singularity. So this is our two extreme cases, one forming a massive, large black hole, the other one very weak field data. Now this is a case where we tuned it to within one part in 10 to the 15, where we got this threshold solution. This is where we get the critical solution. So what starts to happen is the field starts to collapse, but then it starts to echo. And what you can't see in these coordinates is, so what's happening is the scalar field is collapsing. There's sort of a competition between gravity that wants to make it collapse and just the kinetic energy in the field that wants to push it apart. And sort of like you try to balance these two against each other. So it starts to collapse. It shakes off most of the energy. So most of the energy is outgoing, but there's a little core that continues to want to collapse and does so in a self-similar fashion. And like what you didn't see here is that there were sort of two additional echoes of the field. There were two little bounces of the field, but they essentially happened all within the last time step. The interesting dynamics is happening on sort of exponentially small length scales and correspondingly small time scales. And sort of to show you that, I'm going to take this exact same result and transform to logarithmic coordinates, so a logarithmic time coordinate. So time is going to slow down as we approach that point. And I've rescaled the radial coordinates, so switching out to a radial and an angular coordinates, and just adding a constant so that log of zero doesn't give us infinity. And so you can see what that previous one, what's happening is you get this self-similar echoing. So in these logarithmic coordinates, every echo looks exactly the same as the previous one. And in this case, so there were three echoes of the field, and we tuned it to within one part in 10 to the 15, the initial data. And incidentally, so each one of these fronts, they're not part of the critical solution. It's just that little central echoing region. And each one of these fronts is now an outgoing pulse of energy. It's moving outwards at the speed of light. But why it looks frozen is if you notice the coordinates are slowing down, so we can follow the central echoing region. Right? So you see the coordinates are slowing down. So these are actually propagating outwards, but it's a central echoing solution. That's the critical solution. And so this is just sort of what it turns out to be is the threshold solution is something called a discretely self-similar solution. So it's sort of like a self-similar collapse. If you have something like a radial and a time coordinate, the solution actually doesn't depend on these individually. It just depends on the ratio of the two coordinates. That's sort of the definition of a self-similar function in mathematics. And discretely self-similar, there's just an oscillation that's imposed on it. So what I sort of imagined here is you've got this function here. It's collapsing down to this thing called an accumulation point in a finite time. But it's the same structure that's just collapsing down. But if it's discretely self-similar, there's an oscillation imposed in this logarithmic time.
Does this phenomenon occur just for perfectly symmetric initial conditions? Or if you have some sort of asymmetry in initial conditions, do you still see something like this?
Yeah, I'll get right to that. And this by itself, the fact that there's a threshold is not too surprising. But I think what was surprising is now the so-called universality of the solution. So it turns out that you get the same solution regardless of the initial conditions. You start with asymmetries. You start with a different pulse. It doesn't matter. Like all the details of the initial conditions as you approach this threshold get washed away. And you're left with this universal critical solution. So it's apparently universal, so there's no proof in general, but all the studies that people have done suggest that it is universal. The really interesting thing, at least with the scalar field critical collapse, is you get this universal echoing exponent. So that period in logarithmic time is 3.33. And essentially what that tells you, if you go to ordinary time, each one of these echoes happens at 1/30th, so e to the delta, e to the minus delta, on a scale that's 1/30th as small as the previous one, and happens in a time that's 1/30th the previous one. So if you could sort of fine-tune to the exact critical solution in a finite amount of time, you have an infinite number of these echoes all happening, all filling down to an infinitely small scale. And also this, what you find happening is that if you're in a near-critical solution, so this is a sort of, so that the critical solution is discretely self-similar, so it's sort of scale invariant except for this echo. But if you're in a near-critical solution, it's only going to happen for a while, and then it's going to disperse, and there's going to be a certain length scale that's introduced at that dispersal. And what's found is that it follows this universal power law scaling form. So a length scale that arises, so for example, if you form a black hole in a near-critical case, it will have to satisfy this universal power law relationship. And again, this exponent is independent of the kind of initial data you look at. And here's sort of some data from a numerical graph. So there's the periodicity imposes a little wiggle on this, but to leading order, it's this power law. And interestingly, so the question that Matt wanted to answer was, do you form an arbitrary small black hole? If you extrapolate this, in this case, yes, you can always tune your initial data to form a black hole that's as small as you want. And it turned out that the critical solution itself is actually a naked singularity. There's no horizon. And so this was an interesting example where you started from a classical field that in flat space, so if you take Einstein's equation, in flat space with regular initial data, you can mathematically prove it will never evolve to a singular state. And so one statement of the so-called cosmic censorship conjecture, and this is a bet that Stephen Hawking, John Preskill, and Kip Thorne made, was if you start with such kind of initial data and you couple it to gravity, singularities can form because of general relativity. You can form black holes, but they were betting whether you could ever form a naked singularity or not. Whenever a singularity forms, there should always be an event horizon. So this example sort of proved that you could form naked singularities. But you can see, so Stephen Hawking said that, no, there can't be naked singularities. But he said, I conceded on a technicality. And so the technicality was the genericity condition. So this is an example where naked singularity forms, but you have to tune things infinitely precisely. There's only one point in sort of a higher dimensional space that you get that. So now they've got a new bet going that you can form naked singularities with the initial data that's sufficiently generic. Just to show you like one example of trying to test how asymmetric you can do it. So one property of this, as you saw with this echoing, so this is apparently the universal solution. So you see at the origin, if you plotted the scalar field as a function of time, it's just oscillating like this. It's a scalar, it's independent of the coordinates. If it's a universal solution, that better happen. So me and Matt and Steve Liebling and Eric Hirschman wanted to look at, so sort of, well, let's now, we have an axisymmetric code, so let's try and break that conjecture by using data that's anti-symmetric about z equals zero. So you can see, so this is, the value of the scalar field there is minus what it is over there. And that turns out to be a symmetry of the equations that can't be violated. So if this, but the energy density is still roughly spherical, so if this is going to collapse downwards, that point can't oscillate by the symmetry. But then how can that be possible if the solution is supposed to be universal and it should be oscillating? And so this is where we tuned it to within one part in 10 to the 15. And interestingly, what happens is you get these two critical solutions that develop off axis. So the symmetry condition isn't violated. But if you look like locally about one of these points, so far away, yeah, it's not the solution, but these two echoing what look to be exactly spherical critical solutions develop off axis. So, and just to show you, so like I'm going to sort of, again, transform to logarithmic coordinates. So this is just the last time frame. So you can see around that center, you get exactly what you expected from this universality argument. And this is where the other critical solution was in these logarithmic coordinates. So just find things. So again, I say like this was a really nice example where so it completely surprised everyone because they thought, okay, spherical symmetry, it's boring, it's you know, everything that could have been known about the field equations was known, and then this surprising behavior came out. And for example, like the delta and the gamma, they're these universal numbers that are popping out as solutions to the field equations in a system which has no scale. Like, where are they coming from? That's still a complete mystery. Why does that delta equals 3.44 and gamma is 0.37 come from? It's not like with a binary black hole system where we introduced a scale into the problem, that we didn't introduce any additional scales, and yet this is coming out as a universal solution. Just to show you the mesh structure. So this is the last frame. Now I'm just going to zoom in, and so you can see each magnification, 1,600, 500,000. So you can see this thing actually had like 25 levels of refinement. So this also was nice of as a poster child of this kind of mesh refinement. The mesh refinement is used a lot in astrophysics and hydrodynamics, but you rarely are able to get such an efficient thing because the small length scale features that develop are usually more common and sometimes even volume filling. Like if you have shocks or turbulence or things like that, then you usually can't get away with it. So this, what's really nice about this is because of the self-similar collapse, you really only have one point that you really need to refine. So that's the last example that I had there. So this was just sort of to set things in context. You know, now we want to go to the general three-dimensional solution. Whether it's interesting questions in theoretical GR such as critical phenomena. So incidentally, so this kind of threshold behaviors have been observed in any kind of matter that people have studied. So it is observed in fluid stars, for instance. However, because of this fine-tuning mechanism, it's not expected to be astrophysically relevant. At least the kind of processes by which we think black holes form in the universe, even though they might in theory be critical phenomena present, there's nothing in the universe that actually pushes it to that very special threshold point. Except there was one suggestion several years ago that if there's a phase transition in the early universe, in particular, I think it was a QCD phase transition, you could have to natural density fluctuations, you could sort of form a set of black holes on the order of that size, a primordial black hole formation. And then there's not necessarily a fine-tuning mechanism, but essentially at that moment, each little Hubble bubble of the universe, local Hubble volume, that's above the density threshold will form a black hole. But if you look at the distribution of densities relative to the average, it follows a huge distribution. So just by large numbers, they're going to be on average of some number of densities which are going to be very close to this threshold. And you won't see necessarily this echoing behavior, but what will happen is that if there are primordial black holes, it turns out that the spectrum of primordial black holes, you might be able to see this gamma function in the spectrum of primordial black holes. But no one has detected, who knows if there are primordial black holes or where these mechanisms work. But that might be the only place where this critical phenomena could be observed. Okay, so it's already 1:30, right? Yeah, so so I was just going to very briefly go over the derivation of. I'll just explain it in words what I wanted to do, and then we can do it tomorrow. But just want to show you the nature of gravitational waves. You've probably all heard of this before, right? So in general relativity, there are essentially two propagating degrees of freedom. You've got ten metric elements, and so in principle there are 10 things that can fluctuate. But if you choose a gauge, if you're in a flat space where you can actually quantify what a perturbation is relative to that background, and if you eliminate all coordinate degrees of freedom, so you completely fix your coordinate systems. And there's no unique way of doing this, but the way that's commonly done, in particular that H variable that I showed you there, it turns out that these two propagating degrees of freedom, so if you have a gravitational wave that's propagating in one direction, it introduces this oscillation distortion in space-time, but only in the direction transverse to propagation. So if you look at to the gravitational waves propagating here, nothing is changing in this direction. But orthogonal to that, at one instant in time, it will, for example, stretch space in this direction. And at the same instant, it will squeeze space in this direction. And it will oscillate back and forth. So you'll have a stretching, squeezing, that oscillates back and forth. So it's this kind of motion. And that's why, like, LIGO was built the way that it does, right? So you've got LIGO, these 2 4-kilometer-long arms. If a gravitational wave happens to be incident in this direction, and it's using laser interferometry to measure changes in distance between these two arms, if this arm is being squeezed and this one's being stretched, this is sort of a maximally efficient configuration to try to measure those kinds of distance changes. And so if you sort of go through the linearized field equations in so-called transverse traceless harmonic gauge, so you fix all your gauge degrees of freedom, you'll just see that come out of the equations immediately at the linearized level. So you'll see that you get one polarization like this, and the other polarization is exactly the same, but it's rotated by 45 degrees. And then that sort of shows you how you define gravitational waves. And then what we can measure in the simulation that Newman-Penrose scalar Psi4 is just the second time derivative. So Psi4 is actually a complex number. And it turns out that Psi4, the real component, is in an appropriate coordinate system, is the plus polarization. So this will be called the plus polarization. This is the cross. The imaginary component is the cross polarization. This is the second time derivative of that. Okay, any questions? Comments? So I guess, yeah, this afternoon we're going to be mostly just sort of continuing working on the ultra-relativistic fluid. So I'll try and get these notes on the web today, and I'll also try and get the Tucholsky equation. I think for those of you that want to start with that. And then tomorrow we'll do the bit of the gravitational waves. I'll go over the next project, the Tucholsky equation. And then, yeah, we'll just see however many topics we could get. Probably the next thing I'll describe generalized harmonic coordinates. And give an overview of Berger and Oliger style adaptive mesh refinement, which is the flavor of mesh refinement that's common in relativity and is very useful for these kinds of problems. Okay. Okay, well, thank you.